Hey, 99 Pages. Now, how many of us did dry January this year? I imagine a lot, because a record 1 out of every 3 drinkers in the United States right now are trying to reduce their consumption of alcohol. Likely for many reasons. Many of us overconsumed during the pandemic. More research is out now about the increased cancer and disease risk associated with alcohol consumption. And I'm sure, like for many, parenthood made that hangover just not worth it at all. Well, in December, I remember walking into my friend Jess Britt's house, and naturally, I gravitate to a bookshelf. And boy, was I blown away. She had the largest collection of books in this new category, or at least new for me, that I never heard of, a category called Quit Lit. These are a ton of authors and books discussing their journeys with sobriety and the merits, the pains, the struggles. And I asked Jess a truckload of questions about this category of books that I had never really engaged with holistically, and this podcast episode was born. Now look, neither Jess nor I are addiction professionals. We're both just readers who are going to walk and talk about our own stories with alcohol and sobriety together as friends. If you or someone you know is struggling with alcohol abuse, you should really consider reaching out to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration at 1-800-662-4357 for resources in your area. Now, if you enjoy this conversation, please do consider subscribing to our podcast, rating, and sharing us with your family and friends. Those small tasks help us out a ton. Thanks, and enjoy the conversation. And Jess, in your own words, and you know, we can go as deep or as, because I know this journey is personal for everybody, but just so the audience can get to know you, I would love to, and particularly in the context of this discussion about sobriety, would you mind talking to the audience a little bit about how you made that choice? What were some of the milestones on that journey?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I think, you know, when some people ask me, and I'm just trying to answer quickly, I'll sometimes say, you know, it exacerbated my anxiety, and it was a lot easier to eliminate the source of so much of my anxiety. Sometimes I joke, you know, I had an illustrious drinking career and I retired early. That's one of my favorite ones to say. But, you know, to go a little bit deeper, I think it's actually helpful to think back to like when I started drinking, not just when I stopped. So I really started drinking in college. I tried it a couple times in high school. And then I went to college. I was the oldest in my family. I was pretty awkward. I was a little sheltered. And alcohol felt like required to fit in. And it was also just something I had in common suddenly with everybody. You know, I could take shots. I could shotgun beer. I could talk about the hangover the next morning. It was just something that I could use to bond with people socially. And that's what initially, I think, started me down a path of enjoying drinking. And then fast forward into my working life, that kind of social piece of it continued with the work happy hours and the sloppy holiday parties. But I also started business travel, and there was something very like adult and glamorous about drinking wine by myself in a hotel lobby or in a, you know, room service situation. Like there was just a lot that kind of built my habits both socially and by myself early in my drinking life in a way that felt very, very normal. But kind of throughout my whole drinking career, as I'll call it, I would often be able to have 2 or 3. But just as often, I would flip a switch and just drink a lot more than I intended. I didn't really know why. I was always saying, you know, I'm having so much fun. I want to keep drinking. And I grew to dread that. And so did my friends, because that was my way of saying, like, I'm about to drink way too much. And, you know, upon a lot of reflection, I think what I've realized is I'm kind of an overachiever. I have a lot of expectations of myself. And when I drank, I was like, oh, this is a way to shut down that really mean voice in my head that's telling me to do stuff all the time. And, you know, for a while, it was very normal. I thought, you know, I was sharing those hangover stories with people, but I would wake up the next morning and I would just be filled with just like shame and regret.
Oh, yeah.
And anxiety. Like, what did I say? What did I do? And what I've learned since getting sober is that's a very common kind of chemical reaction to alcohol. People call it anxiety in the sober community, that kind of days after feeling. But that didn't make me want to stop. You know, it was like, how do I control this? How do I moderate? Was my mission for a long time. And I wound up doing the Whole 30 in early 2018, which is it's branded as a lifestyle challenge. It's really an elimination diet. You take out sugar and dairy and legumes and kind of all of these things and reintroduce them. And you eliminate alcohol too. And part of the reason I did it, I think secretly, was because I wanted to see if I could actually stop for 30 days. And at the time, I really believed that if I could stop for 30 days on the Whole 30, check the box, I'm not an alcoholic, I can just keep drinking as much as I want. And I did. And that was kind of the beginning of the end. Like that summer, again, I had my rules. Most of the time I was fine, but then I would slip up and have this horrible anxiety spiral. And on one of those mornings, hungover mornings that summer, I ordered This Naked Mind by Annie Grace, which we'll talk about today, I think. And then my last night of drinking was August 1st, 2018. And it was like not that notable. I went out for drinks after work with some coworkers. I biked home. When I got home, instead of drinking water and going to bed, I just kept on drinking. And I woke up the next morning. It was a work day and I was like hungover and felt awful. And I was like, I can't keep doing this to myself anymore. Wow. And so I decided to stop.
And congratulations.
Thanks. I feel like it's important to share this, that, you know, for anyone listening, like I was a very successful young professional, you know, getting promotions. I had just joined a board of directors.
High achieving.
Was like involved with my family. I was a fitness instructor. Like there was so much going on. I was not the picture of who I thought has an alcohol problem. And I think that kept me from not examining this for a long time.
So. Well, you know, Jess, it's actually that last statement, you are not the person who has a problem, that actually made me want to do this podcast because of this list of books. And I'm going to list a few for the listeners that we've written out. And I think you have some as well that you wanted to add, Jess. But This Naked Mind by Annie Grace, The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober by Catherine Gray, Alcohol Explained by William Porter, Dry, a memoir by Augustine Burroughs, Quit Like a Woman by Holly Whitaker, which you gave or let me borrow out of your library, which blew my mind, by the way. I think you had one called Why Can't I Drink Like Everyone Else by Laura McCowan. Is that correct?
That one's by Rachel Hart. And then there are a couple by Laura McCowan that are really good. Yeah.
Ah, forgive me, by Rachel Hart. You're right. So in all of these, at least the ones that I've read, and I've read most of them, I haven't read the Laura McCowan or the Rachel Hart ones, but there is this like preface or first entry chapter where it's almost like the author has to earn the like badge of like, this is why I get to write a book about sobriety. And it's like almost like a contest of who can have the most destructive relationship with alcohol possible. It's like, and then I set my house on fire. And like, and that actually, I understand why that's necessary for the author, and especially when they want to go get published and they have to, you know, drama is going to reel the reader in. No one is going to sell books saying like, yeah, I was having like 3 drinks a week and I woke up a little tired one day and I decided to quit. Like, you can't sell books with that. But on the flip side, it makes these books so unrelatable that it's really hard to kind of say like, actually, I can extract some serious value from them, even though I may not have this extreme problem. Did you find like when you engage with these entry chapters in these books, like especially Annie Grace, like you guys sound nothing alike. Like she's an order of magnitude more severe than you. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree. And I would say, I think it matters. I think the reason that some of these books were so worthwhile to me was because I had already made the decision that I wanted to make a change. And so all of the science was helpful for me that they were sharing. And I wasn't looking to their personal accounts as the measuring stick for whether or not I should quit. And I think that that's where it can be challenging. And I think that that's what a lot of people do when they're struggling with it, especially in our culture around kind of this black and white thinking, do you have a problem or do you not, is you look to other people's behavior as kind of a measuring stick for whether or not you have a problem instead of really asking yourself, is this a problem for me?
Well said. Because we're looking at each other. And when we're at the bar or, you know, even at high-end elite events at Ivy League institutions, they'll like start out everyone with this like classy glass of champagne as you're, and it makes everyone feel elevated. And it's actually like, it's booze, you know, like it's the same drug just in, you know, wrapped in pomp and circumstance. So if everyone's partaking, like, and partaking on the next one, a couple rounds at the happy hour, a couple rounds at dinner, nightcaps, etc., who is actually over consuming, right?
Right.
I want to get your thoughts on this, though. So in advance of this this discussion, I did just a little bit of research. And I, at least in my amateur counting, 2/3 of the books I found in the quitlet category, quitlet, I love that word, by the way, 2/3 are written by women. And this is I've been having this like mind explosion emoji following me around for the past 2 months since I read Quit Like a Woman after you lent it to me, because of her ability, Holly Whitaker's ability, to open my eyes to the way alcohol is uniquely targeting women. And I think you and I had you have a lot of great things to say about this. And I was just wondering if you could help open the reader's brain to this phenomenon of like how like precisely targeted women are by the alcohol industry.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think what was interesting in kind of preparing for this conversation, I went back and read or kind of looked at some notes that I had on some of these books. And I think what was really interesting to me was recognizing kind of the publishing timeline of a lot of this work in relation to my own sobriety. So I quit drinking in 2018. Many of the books that we mentioned came out right around then or in subsequent years. So Holly Whitaker, the author of Quit Like a Woman, for example, and Laura McCowan, who has 2 books on sobriety, they both had a podcast in kind of the mid-2010s, and then came out with their books in 2020. And so a lot of this literature, I think, has been spearheaded by these women and is really relatively recent. And what they are kind of calling out is the way that the alcohol industry has realized that women are a big market and have really marketed their products to women. And once you hear that and start looking for it, you'll see it everywhere. If you look at kind of just marketing around yoga and wine, or looking at in Target, kind of all the witty cards and t-shirts and products that are about Wine O'Clock, or kind of the mommy juice, mom-focused marketing. There is just a lot in there that kind of portrays drinking as a way of being an independent professional woman. And I think what Holly Whitaker does really, really well in Quit Like a Woman is point out how it's a very similar playbook to Big Tobacco a few decades ago, which, you know, blew my mind when I first thought about it. And now that I've seen it, I can't unsee it.
Indeed. Yeah. And I tell you, I even now, one of my most favorite things to do in our friendship, Jess, is every time I see like a poster or a flyer that looks like it's kind of cheeky, promoting alcohol intake for women, I like take a picture of it and I send it to you. And like, I had two, I think I've sent you two now. There was one, actually, no, this text didn't actually go through, but there's this one that there's welcome to Vermont, right?
Yeah.
There's this one where there's a woman and she is holding a cup of coffee and her bottle of wine is behind her. And she's like, I start my day with a warm cup of coffee because it's not yet acceptable to drink wine. And it's just, it's in one of those like 1950s like style commercials. I think I sent you one. This was my favorite. I was at a drugstore, a Kinney's drugstore, and there's a shelf of wine. And, you know, look, I used to live in California for a long time. I know this wine is like, it's okay. You know, It's not great. But they made this big, like, sort of show about how it's, you know, celebrating women in wine. And, you know, there's a picture of like very sophisticated women doing tastings. And I was just like, mind-boggling, like in a drugstore. They're selling, like, I mean, could you imagine if they had like a women in cigarettes section, you know, next to that, celebrating the women in the tobacco industry? It's like, once I see it, I can't stop seeing it. You're so right. And so, like, why do you think women, though? I mean, yes, women, you know, I think are marketed to, and they're obviously a market, but so are men. But I don't see the same gravity of targeting with the men versus the women. Is there something about the female psychology that makes them like really like low hanging fruit for alcohol consumption, or, you know, these industries? Is there something about the female lifestyle in the West that you think sort of drives this marketing tactic towards women?
I would say I think that it's more about kind of growth for alcohol companies. Men have always been marketed alcohol, and the way to increase sales is in part to sell more alcohol to men, but it's also to look at what other markets are untapped. And I think for a long time, women were an untapped market, and the companies have realized that that's a big way to kind of seize on you know, a market share that they hadn't been considering before. And, you know, these aren't my, you know, original thoughts. These are from all the books that we've been referencing. And I also think that there are, you know, things that are kind of broken in our society, at least this is my own viewpoint, kind of politically speaking, that put pressure on women in a particular way that then alcohol is marketed as a solution for. So when I think about kind of some of the mommy wine culture that is seen in marketing, there are parts about being a parent in our society that are very hard. And this is marketed as a way, as a fix to it, instead of looking at kind of bigger systemic ways to solve problems that would actually support women and mothers in particular.
I think that is incredibly wise. And actually, I'm not a mother, I'm a father. But when I look at my wife and our alcohol consumption, I think it was actually having children that made us dramatically decrease our consumption. Like, mm-hmm. I think it was in my eldest daughter was born in March. We were at her baptism in Cincinnati in June. And I just remember at one point, I mean, I was talking to some of her other relatives at the time who had gone on this journey, and just being more inspired and seeing myself in a lot of the problems they were saying, talking about. And again, very high functioning adults. None of them had any of these crazy dramatic stories, but like I saw myself in their, like in their, the way they identified who they were. And there was a few statements like, I just didn't want alcohol to be the reason that I wasn't the best version of myself. Yep. That was actually one of my wife's uncles. And I just, when he said that, I was just like, yeah, that's a stupid reason not to be the best version of myself. It's because of a couple of drinks. And anyways, over and over, I just decided. And then, you know, when you have a kid and you're waking up in the middle of the night constantly, you're not sleeping, and you end up being, your threshold for compassion to your significant other just depletes. It's like, I don't understand how people with children can drink. It just like blew my mind. And it's interesting to me that it's marketed, like motherhood in particular, is marketed as an opportunity to sell wine. When for me, it was like, and my wife as well, it was like the moment where we decided to part ways with it. Yeah. That's actually kind of sad to because it's a vulnerable state. Right, is those early months of parenthood. So really fascinating.
And I should clarify that, you know, I am not a parent, and I have seen it go both ways with friends who are. I think there are some for whom, you know, they seriously reduce their consumption while pregnant or while kind of going through that adjustment, and some of those habits stick. And then, you know, I do see on social media in particular how some of that marketing and messaging can be so insidious. And for folks who are struggling, it becomes a way to bond with other parents and a way to cope and a way to say, you know, I deserve this because this is hard.
Yeah. So we've talked about a couple things that I want to crystallize here. One, I think we've hit on the pedestal that we put alcohol in on our society. You know, there is always a fashionable, classy way to consume alcohol. It's a treat yourself night, classy bottles of champagne. Oh, I've had a hard work day. Whether you're a man pouring yourself a tumbler of bourbon at the end of the day in a, you know, Don Draper Mad Men sort of fashion, or you're on the, you know, it's like a bottle of Veuve after a big celebration, you know,
rosé all bottles. Day.
Rosé all day. It's like we've made this, this activity of alcohol consumption so casual, so sexy. We've put it on a pedestal. Yet, and what's the other interesting thing the second thing I think we've touched on is really important is it's hard to tell if you have a problem when your behavior blends in with everyone else's. And the reason why that's important is one, everyone's definition of what is problematic different drinking is different, right? So some people will have no problem, you know, with their body, their life, their standards for themselves consuming, you know, 10 drinks a week. Whereas I think that there's a lot of us who, you know, like my uncle said to me, like, you don't want alcohol to be the version that you're not, you know, performing at an elite level in a given thing, whether it's your work, your athletics, et cetera. Like that, it was just too much. I was a worse parent, a worse professional, a worse athlete. I needed to give it away. And that deficiency was missing in a social context. And I don't think I actually could have gone sober had it not been for the pandemic. And I was locked in and like, I didn't have that like social scene, that gravity pulling me into the bars with all my friends. I was at home looking at my chubby belly and being like, man, that ski slope is looking exhausting right now. I need to clean up my act.
I really like something that Laura McCowan writes in one of her books, which is the typical question is this bad enough for me to have to change? And I totally asked myself that. I Googled that so many times. And then she says, the question we should be asking is this good enough for me to stay the same?
Whoa. Yeah. That is the question. If there's only one thing I think our listeners should walk away with today is that question. It's not about, is it a problem? But is it good enough for you to stay the same indefinitely? And for some people, I think the answer will probably be yes. You know, they're very satisfied with their, and for some people, I think moderation is a thing. I personally don't know what that's like.
Same.
Okay. And then what's something I really want to hit on, and another thing that sort of has cultivated this podcast episode is the concept of dry January. So you did Whole 30 and it was kind of the beginning of the end, but you said to yourself at the beginning, if I can do this for 30 days, you know, at least at the onset, you said I'm probably fine. How do you react to this concept of dry January where we as a, you know, social society decide, hey, the holidays were rough. We got a little ahead of ourselves. Let's just clean up our act for January so we can continue the behavior February through December. What are your thoughts on dry January? And is it actually helping or hurting the problem?
I think anything that invites people to examine their relationship with alcohol in any form is a step in the right direction. And I think that it is very easy to do what I did with the Whole 30 during dry January, which is white knuckle your way through 30 days, really look forward to drinking at the end and kind of commiserate with people about how hard it is and not actually do any of the work around questioning your beliefs around alcohol and examining your habits and motivations for using it. And so I think if you are kind of doing that mindfulness and work along with dry January, and then you decide to reintroduce it at the end, I think that that is a healthy way to engage in it. If, you know, what I did when I quit and what I would encourage anyone to do who's considering it is to set a longer bar than dry January. So I committed to 100 days at the beginning. That felt like I wasn't committing to a lifetime, which was too intimidating for me. But I think is long enough that you can't just get by on white knuckling and willpower alone. You have to start introducing other habits and you have to spend some time with yourself. And I think that's what can be missing, I think, sometimes with dry January. I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, I actually agree completely. Like the word white knuckling is so good. And especially for the kinds of people who are like high achieving social drinkers that might let themselves have a few more drinks too many every now and then, which I'd argue both of us were kind of in that category. Like Yeah, hell yeah. I can white knuckle through anything. Absolutely. There's nothing I can't take down for 30 days, right? No behavior. Right. Someone can challenge me. A while back, someone, actually, it was the same uncle that told me that phrase about being the best version of myself. He had 100 burpees a day for 30 day challenge. And I white knuckled through it all the way to a back spasm, but I did it. It broke my body to it. But I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's just like, if you're that persistent and determined, you can get through it. And I think we can convince ourselves that it's not a problem. So I got to tell you, Jess, I believe that this concept of dry January fits into the same bucket as the industry sponsored phrase, drink responsibly. And so for those, and I learned this in the book, Quit Like a Woman, which the phrase drink responsibly puts the onus of managing an addictive substance, a carcinogenic substance, exclusively on the user, right? It's like, just drink responsibly. It's your job, you know, and then we'll have a nice scene of a really classy person in the background, presumably having the time of their life, but telling you just drink responsibly as if they're basically saying cheers. To me, the concept of dry January is exactly what you're describing. It's taking people who should be having these internal discussions about their relationship with alcohol, but telling them that, hey, if you can white knuckle through 30 days of being dry, you're probably good. And keep giving us your money for the $50 bottles of champagne and the bottle service at the club. That's I actually view dry January as quite destructive. How does that resonate with you?
I agree in a lot of ways, especially seeing how so many alcohol companies have jumped on the bandwagon of marketing and creating non-alcoholic products to go along with Dry January. I think that piece of it all has been fascinating to watch kind of from this side of having quit. And I would also say in the last couple of years in particular, I think I have noticed more and more people talking about damp January. And people like memes about how like they would never do dry January. Like there's been kind of this online, just kind of interesting humor and exceptionalism around it that I have found fascinating. And what I would, you know, as someone who has kind of gone through the back and forth of quitting and then reintroducing and then quitting for good and then kind of figuring out what my, you know, relationship is with it, what I would offer to people is that there really are, you know, chemical, physiological aspects of having consumed alcohol that take a long time to leave your body. And so if you are doing damp January, you may not really be able to interrogate your relationship with alcohol and feel what it really feels to not have it in your system. So
I had no idea that was a thing, damp January. That's mm-hmm. actually kind of, it actually, it makes me a little sad to think that even the white knuckling, which is a pretty powerful force in a lot of people's lives who are, you know, high achieving folks, like that ability to just, you know, not accept defeat in the face of a challenge, especially one that's for in a predictable context is 30 days. That's sad that even that level of resolve is leaving the system, if you will.
Yeah. And I mean, generally, I think I am a fan of a harm reduction approach to things. And again, as I said at the beginning of this part of the conversation, I think any invitation to examine your relationship with it and kind of introduce some intentionality is better than not. And I think it kind of defeats some of the purpose that was originally conceived around Dry January.
So, but this is key, right? The absence of alcohol consumption doesn't indicate the presence of introspection, right? Sure. So, you know, not drinking, and that's, I think, is kind of scary, is to think that like there are people out there who might be going through dry January just simply avoiding alcohol, but just saying like you said, white knuckling through, it's like, all right, I'm not drinking. That's okay. February 1st is coming. I'll just, you know, wait. But not necessarily look at that time period as an opportunity to understand their relationship with that beverage. And this is actually where I think we can spend the bulk of our next few minutes here, because this to me is the key, is when we talk about consuming, like, I'm curious, when think back to those days when you're a high achieving drinker, if you will. And let's say you finish I don't know, a day of work, or you finish a afternoon workout with a friend and you reach for a beer, you reach for a glass of wine. What are some of the things that it meant to you? Like, can you describe what would go through your head and what you were searching for, like, and the answers that you found during your periods of introspection?
Oh, I mean, I think, you know, as I said in my introduction, I think there was a lot around belonging and kind of fitting in with people. I think it was helping me feel less nervous and anxious in certain social situations. And it was also helping me chill out and be more fun. Like, I thought that's what it was doing. It was helping me kind of relax and not be that kind of intense, you know, need to be in control, high achieving person anymore. It was like, I can have fun too, and I deserve to have fun, was a little bit of what it was doing for me. And that's actually, you know, that book, Why Can't I Drink Like Everyone Else by Rachel Hart. She really, most of the book is really just journal prompts for you to fill in the blanks around people who drink are, people who don't like to drink are, people who can't control how much they drink are, really kind of working to, you know, examine those underlying beliefs that I didn't even know I had. And I think that was really helpful for me.
I got to tell you, I think this is, you know, what's funny is we would text a little bit about like, why, you know, why is this conversation hard and awkward? And I think we're getting to that point where it is hard and awkward to start talking about some of this stuff. Man, I think if I'm being completely honest, there is a lot of like self-loathing that I would uncover when I went through this journey of like, what am I thinking when I reach for that drink? And it's yeah, whether it's just like feeling sorry for myself, feeling just like I need to relax, need to calm down, need to treat myself. Like, there's so many difficult parts of just being an adult, right?
For me, sometimes it was boredom and loneliness, and I didn't recognize that at the time. It felt like, oh, if I'm bored or I'm home alone and, you know, cooking, I can have wine and suddenly like I'm treating myself to a fun, you know, afternoon of like meal prepping. And then in reality, it was like, oh no, you drank a whole bottle of wine by yourself. Like, that's not actually treating yourself.
Yeah. I mean, and I get it, right? Like, there's something about the monotony of adulthood, you know, and many of us have, you know, in some way, shape, or form, some combination of whether it's student loans, a home mortgage, you know, a decent sized car payment, you know, other financial goals, whether it's travel, retirement, saving up for a home or a renovation, or maybe you, everyone I know is dealing with some degree of family stress. You know, this is about the age where like our relationships with our parents start, you know, flexing, right? Because there's not a definite like superior subordinate sort of situation when it's like you're a 10-year-old and you got to follow your mom's orders or dad's orders. It's like now we may not be peers, but we certainly not in a firm hierarchy. You're an independent woman. I'm an independent guy, right? Like, and we still get together for these family events. There's still tons of family triggers, even though they might be innocuous to outsiders in the moment. As a person who grew up in an environment, certain triggers can really set us off. And then of course, as families grow and expand with children, I think people, me included, I think sometimes I can, what's the word? Project, maybe, like too much of my own. Like, I got to tell you, I have this sort of like hyper insane vigilance that sort of almost, it's a tool that I picked up in the army, right? Where the enemy only has to be right once. I have to be right. Me and my soldiers have to be right 100% of the time. There's a no excuses, no failures allowed type of mentality that I have applied in some degree to my parenting strategy. things around, like screen time, nutrition, like how much sugar are they going to have? How many, you know, how many hours of screen time? Does it matter if it's a FaceTime with a family member versus a Cocomelon episode? Being outside versus inside, how many toys are okay? Is it okay if the toy has batteries and flashy lights, or does it have to be like some sort of, you know, Montessori piece of wood with a wheel on it? And I struggle, like all that tension that builds up has to have a release valve, right? And man, oh man, if a bottle of wine doesn't feel like a good release valve, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's important to be honest. I am at a point where I don't crave it very often at all. But those are the moments when I generally say this to my husband. I say, I have no interest in drinking right now, and I have no interest in being hungover tomorrow. But boy, do I miss how easy it was to get rid of this emotion by drinking. And I'm a little jealous that I can't just go have a glass of wine and relieve it. And then I reframe it and I say, you know what? I could, but I have chosen not to. And I continue to choose not to, because that's not going to ultimately be in my best interest.
So two things I want to point on there. One, I love the way you describe it. It's like, I have chosen this life strategy. I don't want to be hungover tomorrow, but this is a moment. You're vocalizing it to your partner. Like, I just want to call out, this is a moment where I really want a drink. And and I think that's so special that you do that. You pause the moment, you slow down time, and then you call it out. Like, I want a drink right now. Imagine if every one of our listeners, if they just took that one behavior, like, and maybe some of them will say, yes, I will drink. But the fact that they just slowed down time to say, like, hey, I want one right now. I want to think through, am I okay with a little bit of a hangover later? Am I okay feeling a little lethargic? You know, am I okay with all the compromises that I'm going to make somewhere down the line? And for many, the answer might still be yes, but even just slowing it down, I think, is so key. And you know, that word, I think Chelsea and I use is levity. You know, we miss that feeling of like levity, the silliness, you know, the escapism, right? Mm-hmm. It's levity is almost a positive connotation on, we're just escaping from the moment. Yeah.
I also think it's like, what is the underlying why? And am I comfortable with that being the why behind me having a drink? And for me, so often in those kind of moments, it's, you know, I'm in a tense situation with family or friends that is not enjoyable to me. Mm-hmm. And it would be easier if I was drinking, or I'm really stressed and anxious about this thing with work. And to me, those used to be very good reasons to drink, and those are no longer good enough reasons for me.
And good for you.
Yeah.
Man, congratulations. One thing I really want us to talk about is your journey with alcohol in relation to your partner. Because just like, you know, another crazy life thing that I did was I went vegan. Actually, I don't think it's that crazy, but I will just say I went vegan. And, you know, Chelsea, bless her heart, you know, was very comfortable going vegetarian. Like, we used to love chicken and roast chicken and stuff like that, but she was willing to go vegetarian. And the more vegan I have become and plant-based whole food I have become, she's actually been really gracious and sort of, okay, we're still going to share the same refrigerator. We don't have to make two different meal plans. Like, we will eat as a family. And Chelsea has been really supportive in changing the way she eats to support my goals. And I am totally grateful for her. And she did the exact same in many ways with alcohol, you know. Our relationship kind of grew up in wine country in California. We would go to wine country almost 30 days a year, 1 year, you know, like really a lot of time. And she loves great wine and food. And yet when I made the decision to go sober, I noticed she also kind of was very supportive and, you know, really either on purpose or inadvertently started reducing her alcohol intake as well and being supportive for me. It wasn't like I was the one trying to abstain and she was just popping bottles every night on a Tuesday, right? Like, she was really supportive. And your husband, Ted, is also really, really supportive. And I think it's really important to acknowledge, like, I'm curious with you and Ted, did you guys have like a conversation of did you have to make a sales pitch? What I'm saying here is it's really hard to go down this journey if your partner's not on board with you, right?
Yeah. So I think this reveals that we are still newer friends and still getting to know each other, because I was actually single when I decided to go sober. And figuring out, or kind of facing that I was going to be dating without drinking, was a huge part of my resistance to quitting. And then a really hard part of my initial kind of post-quitting journey. And I went through many experiences of, you know, telling people in advance that I don't drink, but like pretending I was fine meeting up with at a bar. And then, you know, the number of people who were like, oh, I don't drink that much either. And then, of course, they do drink like most people in our culture drink. It was fascinating to me. And then I met my husband, probably Ted, about 6 months after I quit. And he told me he didn't really drink. And I was like, yeah. And then I realized, you know, as we got to know each other, he grew up in a pretty religious environment, and a lot of his friends had also grown up in that environment. And while not practicing now, don't drink or drink very little. And so he actually has had like a similar level of sobriety to me, but coming from a completely different angle.
That's right.
And yeah. So
I actually knew that story.
Now did you know that?
Okay. Yeah, I did. But I'm glad you told it to me again, yeah, because I had forgotten. And by the way, real quick. So you're like, let's just say you're on, I don't know, fucking Tinder or something like that. And you get a message like, yeah, and you're chatting with this guy. He invites you to a bar and you say, sure, I'm happy to meet there, but I don't drink. How is the next like message not, oh, no problem, let's go to a coffee shop or let's go get some ice cream? Like, did you find the guys on the apps were like willing to change their game plan when they find out that you didn't drink?
It really depended. and I think that was also part of my own personal work at that time in early sobriety, was figuring out like, what are my standards and like, how much people pleasing am I going to do as a sober person in the dating world? Because I was, you know, I wanted to find a partner. I wanted to like not be a buzzkill. You know, I wanted to, you know, fit in still. But at what point was I just kind of saying I was okay, but I wasn't actually okay? And that was some of the work that I had to do. So.
Wow. Oh my goodness. I mean, I feel like we could have a whole conversation on this, like on a meta level, because on one hand, there's like the, you know, where you're at in this mind, you know, young, single, newly trying out the sobriety thing. And you will go to a bar because you're questioning how much people pleasing you want to do. Then there's another level of, nope, I'm not going to go to a bar because I'm a worthwhile, valuable person, and I deserve a man who's going to think and be considerate about my needs. And I'm going to wait for someone who's going to suggest the coffee shop. But then there's I think almost like this actualization level of like, I can be anywhere. I can be with anyone in any context, and I'm secure in who I am. And if other people want to drink, so be it. But I am my own independent person. And sure, I'd be happy to go to a bar with you. That's
Absolutely.
A tough journey.
And I would say that I think people in early sobriety, or I'll speak for myself, I think I wanted to be that last version right away. And it took going through all the phases to be truly okay in certain environments with alcohol, in a way that was genuine and not just because I felt like I should be.
Fascinating. That's, first off, I've spoken like a true high achiever. It's like, I ain't going to do this journey part. I'm just going to go straight to the top. Actualize me. Let's go. And so like, just out of curiosity, I mean, okay, we've been talking a lot about our significant others, and we both have been very blessed with significant others that have been really supportive on the journey. I'm curious, have you had relationships that have faltered when you made this journey to go sober?
I think there are definitely certain people and groups of people and activities that I did with people that I have realized I enjoyed because of the alcohol, but actually without alcohol aren't actually that fun, or are kind of boring, or aren't kind of giving me what I need. And I have, over, you know, it's been 5.5 years now, I am much more comfortable saying, you know, I'm going to invest in the things that really kind of get in relationships that really, that I enjoy as a sober person, and not think so much about what I used to do, if that makes sense.
Interesting. So it's not necessarily that relationships have faltered, but you've just been more, I don't know, maybe you have a little bit more franchise in your life to put yourself in the context and with the people that make you happiest. Is that a way of saying it?
I think that some relationships, I think I have grown apart from some folks where it turned out that drinking together was really what we had in common. But there are other friendships and family relationships where I have been so pleasantly surprised to realize, oh, I was the one who was driving that drinking party. And actually, there's a lot there foundationally that we can continue to build on and do different types of things together.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I would actually, yes, and that. Maybe it's not necessarily the sobriety, but like we were talking about earlier, it's the introspection and the journey and the work that has been done. There are absolutely friends in my life that haven't done that hard work. And I think especially, you know what? You know, you guys were in Boston for many years. We were in San Francisco. I lived in New York for many years. Like when you're in these primate cities where they're like heavy industrial focus, lots of, you know, really ambitious, globally achieving people walking around, it can be, you know, it's just really hard to get some space and to do that hard work and introspection about what really matters in life. And I found more so than just the alcohol, you know, the alcohol was just sort of like a symptom. The journey to realizing I'm very secure in who I am in an environment where everyone's drinking and I don't really need to partake, that sort of journey required me to step away from my trajectory in the rat race, if you will. And I found that when I went sober and some of my friends didn't, and they kept on, you know, pursuing these really, in my opinion, superficial financially motivated goals or sort of reputationally motivated goals, I grew apart from them. And the alcohol was just like kind of it's just the cherry on top. It was really our values had changed. Did you at any point consider just moderation, like 2 drinks a week? Why the full sober?
I mean, moderation was my game starting in college. It was, I'm not going to have more than 3 drinks at any one time. I'm not going to drink at all during the week. I only drink wine and beer, never hard alcohol. Like, I had so many rules. At one point, I had a journal that was like, how many drinks did I have last night? How do I feel today? You know, there was a lot there where I tried to, and I was monitoring everybody else around me. And I was like, I don't think I'm normal, I guess, you know? And I think what I ultimately realized was I was treating the symptoms, not the root cause. You know, I was trying to figure out, how do I be less anxious when I'm hungover?
Uh-huh.
Instead of questioning, like, why do I just stop being hungover? I kind of just realized it wasn't worth the mental space that it was taking up anymore. And there's actually, it wasn't on our list, but there's an ebook that I found really early called Tired of Thinking About Drinking.
Ooh.
And it just like gave language to what I'm talking about, where like quitting frees you from questioning and doing that mental gymnastics and making all those decisions all of the time. And having your default be no just takes away so much of that noise. At least that was my experience.
Well said. I like that. You know, it's cool to talk to you because I feel like there's a, you know, there's like a pithiness to the way you, a quotability that you have. It's just, and, you know, walking into your living room with your library of Quitlet and just being in awe at how much reading you've done on this, it's really refreshing and something that I don't think gets talked about in circles, like in just kind of more social random circles, just like the ones we have, right? Where we happen to be sober, but we also didn't have the kind of like, you know, crazy blackout drunk, you know, every other day kind of stories that some of these authors did. But in just like normal working professional circles, it's just so impressive to hear how fluently you can reference these books, reference their philosophies, and bring them into a conversation like this. I'm just really impressed. I want to start working into maybe some strategies. You know, I think this conversation has been really great for those who might have not been. I think anyone who's listening to this right now is probably at least, hopefully at least challenging themselves and just asking themselves, like, do I want to explore my relationship with alcohol? Is it in a healthy area? Have I done the introspection to know that when I reach for a beverage, it's with the right intent, the right reasons, and I'm expecting, you know, I've negotiated the consequences. But let's say that there are folks that haven't, you know, done that hard work and we're stepping towards sort of the tactics of being sober. Like, how did you start tactically being sober? Like, what did you order to drink at the bar? What did you stock your fridge with? What did you tell your friends? I'm curious about in the early days, what your strategies were.
So that very first day, I told a couple people. I was crying because, you know, alcohol is a depressant. And I wound up meeting up with a very generous coworker who was actually in AA. And he took me to an AA meeting. And I cried the whole time. And I never went back. And I say this not because AA isn't helpful. I think some people find so much good in those spaces and find a lot of comfort in the labels and the structure and everything. That was not me at all. And if you told me that I had to keep going there, if I wanted to be sober, like I probably would have stayed stuck a lot longer. Oof. And so what I'll share is, you know, I committed to that 100 days. I didn't find interpersonal community right away, but I found a lot of online community. So I actually joined an app called Daybreak, which is totally anonymous, and you can write any time of day, like what you're struggling with. So like I would sign in there, like going to my first wedding sober, going on a date sober, and be like, I want a drink. And a bunch of people would, you know, jump in, kind of like what a sponsor in AA I think would do, but it was totally anonymous and kind of 24/7 online. And so that was something I did. I followed a ton of Instagram accounts. So a lot of the writers we've referenced in this conversation had a big Instagram presence at the time. And so that was huge for me, was like reading their quotes, reading their stories, like having kind of a parasocial relationship with them, I think helped me. Reading all the Quitlet, I like binged podcasts by some of these people as well. Like I felt like, oh my God, I found my people and they're in my ears. So all of that was helpful. And then in terms of kind of tactically speaking, I ordered tonic a lot to start because it looked like vodka tonic. And to me, it was enough of a difference from like club soda that I still felt like special. I don't know. That was my tactic for a long time. And I think there's that like Mr. Rogers quote that is, find the helpers.
Huh.
Do you know that one?
Like
when something's scary in the world, look for the helpers. And I've been thinking about that as I thought about this conversation, because I would turn it on its head and say, look for the other people not drinking, because they're there. Like, people who are pregnant, people who are religious, people who have an alcohol intolerance, people who are also in recovery, people who just aren't drinking tonight. I can remember going to a happy hour for work 2 weeks after I stopped and realizing that 7 out of 10 people ordered seltzer. And my mind was blown, because in my previous like mindset, I would have focused on the 3 people who ordered booze, and I would have been checking and seeing like, are we ready to order the next round? And like, am I having more than them? And all of that. But when I started focusing on who's not drinking, it was like, oh, a lot more people don't drink than I realized.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. How about that? That's that is a really wonderful anecdote. And I love the note about tonic. I agree. Tonic, especially, I think it's called, what's it? The Fever Tree? Fever Tree tonics.
That's like, those makes you feel real classy. Yep.
Yeah. That's good stuff.
Their grapefruit soda is also very good.
Oh, I've never tried that. That's a good tip. Maybe I'll grab that at the grocery store next time. Something I know we both have a decent amount of is like near beers, athletic beers.
Athletic, for example.
And I know there are a couple other companies. I think Athletic is by far the best known right now. And as you said, like Heineken, Bud Light, like a lot of the big beer manufacturers have a non-alcoholic version now as well. Just curious, like, have you thought, I have a lot of thoughts on this personally, but I want to start with you. Like, do you have a sort of role that these beverages sort of play in your journey?
I think very early on, I sought a lot of them out, and I can remember Athletic had recently been founded, and I like wrote to the founder and was like, I love your beer. How can I get it near me? And he told me who his distributor was near me. And I like went around to restaurants and, stores in my neighborhood and said, I want you to have this. And they got it. So that was a big thing for me early on, a lot of Athletic. I still drink it a lot, but I would say I'm now 5.5 years into this journey, and I usually just drink one in a night. I'm not drinking like multiple beers in the way that I did when I first started. I used to drink a ton of kombucha. I still love kombucha, but I drink, you know, more water and seltzer. It's I think I've changed my mindset and habits enough that it's not a replacement anymore. It's just like a variety in my drinking.
Yeah, that I think that's really well said. I think for me, Athletic is it's still, I would argue it's a once every other night or something like that, complement to like a home cooked dinner during the week as a means of like, I gotta admit, it feels a little special. It's cold. I love the crack of the can. It tastes good. And it's like when I would, casually open a bottle of wine or casually crack open a beer, like that sort of like chill, the carbonation, the hoppiness, like I still get a lot of the ceremony knocked out and it's in midweek, but you're right. Like I no longer go for multiple. I used to go for multiple. Now it's like one a night. And the other thing is like, we've thrown in like these sort of like, kombucha seltzers or shrubs, you know, like little vinegar, lemony, fancy drinks. And it's actually led to another discovery. Being sober, at least now, like I haven't actually saved like a ton of money. At least I don't think so. Because like, I love to like spend money on like cool mocktails and cool alternative products. And so I don't know. I just kind of feel like, it's kind of funny. Like there's enough of a growing market of really flashy, cool, non-alcoholic beverages out there that I'm willing to like try that. I don't necessarily think that being sober has like been this amazing like addition into my bank account.
I think what I save money on is like the volume. It's the like going out to the bar and like picking up a round for everybody. It's the like ordering pizza after the fact, like all of that stuff. But I agree with you. I think even, you know, some of the beverages cost just as much, if not more, than some of what I used to spend on alcohol.
Oh, yeah. By the way, in addition to the tips, I think it's really good that you called out like telling your partner, like, boy, I feel tempted. And I actually tell my partner, I tell Chelsea, I'll actually ask her if I'm in a low spate. I'll be like, can you make sure I don't drink tonight? And I think just like saying that aloud, even though, I really like, especially my wife is, you know, she's like a, you're not crazy. Let's do it. You know, she'll egg me on to anything, right? We have this competitive sort of rat-a-tat. It's very playful. And so like getting it out there, right away. And she's always been like, yeah, no problem. I got you. And it's never been a big deal. So I think like, yeah, in terms of tips, like there's absolutely products that you can look into, whether it's Athletic or otherwise. I think Recess is another brand that I'm really into right now. Fever Tree, obviously. Looking for the people at a social event who also aren't drinking so that when things get a little nutty, you got some people that you can lean on, whether it's religious folks, pregnant folks. I mean, there's actually a half a dozen categories folks you can look for, making sure your partner is on board. I'm just curious, like, how about, you know, I'm just, and feel free to dodge this question or not, but I'm curious about, let's say, marijuana or any other, like, when we say sober, is that inclusive of other ways to escape? Is there something very specific to alcohol about this conversation? Or do you think that that does your discipline actually go beyond just alcohol to other substances?
Oh, I think that this is so complicated. And you may have noticed, people may have noticed that throughout this conversation, I've talked about quitting and I've talked about being a non-drinker. I have a mixed relationship even with the label sober, because I know that that means something so specific to so many people. And I think by some definitions, I'm not sober, right? I'm not always sober. And so I will from time to time, and I'm talking like twice a year, like have an edible or half an edible. And I will still from time to time have half a glass of wine in a particular situation that is very mindful for me. And so I have kind of gotten in touch with myself around, these are all the reasons that are not good enough.
Yeah.
And if that's an underlying factor here, like I'm not gonna do it. But like if I'm traveling and I'm at like a food tasting and they make wine and, you know, I'm gonna have a taste of it, like to me, I'm still sober because of all the work that I've done for the last 5.5 years, and my kind of default is as a non-drinker. Some people in the sober community would say that doesn't count. Like you are back to square, just as, whatever.
You're just as bad as the guy. Yeah. And you know, I don't mind telling people as well, like I'm in a similar boat. And I think that's important to acknowledge, is like, even within the term quote unquote sober, I think you're absolutely right. It's actually not really, to me, it was helpful. And what I tell my friends is, sober is a label, and the label is only helpful if you put the label to work for you. And I put the label sober to work for me because I found that if I announce myself as sober to everyone I know, not just a non-drinker, and then I go through this like tiptoe around everything, but I just say flat out to everyone I know, I'm sober. No, everyone's like, okay, cool. And they accept it. But more importantly, I have such a strong value of integrity that I refuse to let anyone else see me violate that integrity by taking a drink, right? I refuse to, like, so if I announce to the world that I'm sober, which I have, like that builds in social pressure so that I will never drink in public again, really, because everyone I've told, everyone I know knows that I'm sober. It's like this wonderful sort of like, even
insurance.
When I'm at, yeah, it's insurance. And because I have done a lot of work on this journey, but boy, oh boy, I ain't perfect. I'm still human.
That's and, what my tattoo says. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. No.
It says not perfect, only human.
that's beautiful right there. Maybe I should get a matching tattoo. We can have that in common. I use the label to my advantage in that regard. But I think it's also important to acknowledge, like, you know, especially after 5 years, you know, I'm on year like three. I think there's really awesome nuance that you can build to carve out, like, what is the purpose that this exact substance is serving, whether it's a psychedelic shroom, a edible, a joint, a glass, a tasting of a wine in on a travel excursion. Like really having a hyper precise definition of what the role of that addictive substance is serving in your life, I think is absolutely something that a person in control of their intake can achieve. And it sounds like you've gone there.
Yes.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
And I think another tool that I use is like when I do decide to maybe, you know, have a little taste of something here or there because it's like the novelty, we're traveling, whatever. My one stipulation is that Chelsea is always present, and like it's you know, I have to get a buy-in from the wife because she's That's kind of crazy, you know, like I've kind of co-opted her into this journey and like made her my accountability partner in a lot of ways. I think it's important for others to know. It's just like, you know, it doesn't have to be for everyone. It doesn't have to be like this draconian line. Mm-hmm. It can be something where you can carve out nuanced exceptions for at your own pace and use the label to serve you, whatever.
And there are plenty of people just like you and me who will decide it is easier to just never question the decision and just make it black and white. and like, that's okay too. And I think what we're talking about, and I think this is something that Holly Whitaker does really well in her book, is really give the invitation to figure out what works for you. She has a chapter called Navigating the Sober Illuminati. Like there is this culture in the community around rules, and figuring out what works for you is such an important piece of this. I think it's something that's still evolving in our culture.
Yeah,
for sure.
You know, as you said that, I think something that's interesting is that you had mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous as one of the steps that you took on the journey. And I do have friends who go to AA, but I think it's pretty easy to show that AA is one. It's not really known for evolving, if you will. It's very male dominated too, and rooted in some religion and religious aspects that some might find just counterproductive, right? And yet at the same time, I think it's like the dominant known community if you want to go sober. And it just feels like, all right, I'm trying to reduce or control my alcohol intake, go sober. And so my main option is Alcoholics Anonymous, which is, if I could define it in an adjective, it would be righteous, right? They're very righteous philosophies. And I think what I'm seeing now in the 2020s is that, like, actually, no, there are other communities that are coming up that can offer more, I hate to say the word moderated, but like just different ways of accommodating worldviews and lifestyles that are a little bit more, you know, contemporary. And I think that's something that we have benefited from for sure. Jess, I really enjoy this conversation. I mean, something, you know, alcohol and this journey of going sober is something very personal and it's sensitive, it's personal, and it's ripe for both external and self-judgment. And I'm just really grateful that you took the time to have this conversation with me, that you've been an anchor for me and my community, because someone who has a library of books about sobriety, obviously I'm going to grab onto. And so I really appreciated not just the conversation, but your friendship and just, just your role in my journey. It's really meant a lot.
Same. Thanks for having me on and for the conversations both on the podcast and off about this.
Indeed. Well, that was our show. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, would you consider please rating us on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Those ratings help us out a ton. Also, consider going to 99pages.club, C-L-U-B, and joining our email list. Each month, I send out just two emails, one promoting our most recent podcast interview, but a second with some book recommendations for your nonfiction reading list. So far, the reviews have been really great. People like getting those unique reads on their list that they otherwise would not have found. So that's 99pages.club, C-L-U-B. Thanks, and we will be back very soon.